Let's welcome Daniel.
Hey guys. Quick question. Quick poll. Who here reads or writes poetry? Anyone? Oh, thanks. Okay, one, two. Okay. Alright, so I take it my suspicions are confirmed. Poetry is falling quickly out of fashion. Hopefully I will do what I can tonight to revive it a little bit. C.S. Lewis, in one of his books, A Preface to Paradise Lost, it's more of an academic book, he says this. It is easy to forget that the man who writes a good love sonnet needs not only to be enamored of a woman, but also to be enamored of the sonnet. And this is the way things are in regards to the book that I'm sharing tonight. A book called The Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience by the British poet William Blake. They were compiled and made more formal in 1804. He was one of the early Romantic poets, and he is considered one of the greatest artists in all of Britain, or the greatest artist Britain, one of the greatest artists Britain has ever produced. Because not only did he write poetry, but he did illumination around it, with like special techniques and stuff like that. But tonight I'll just be sharing more so about his literary merits, namely his poetry, and particularly this book. I love this book because I love it not only for what it says, but really its poetry for how it says it, and the two are kind of inseparable. And just like Lewis was saying, for me to love this book, I not only need to love its content, the object of its expression, but the expression itself. And so because of that, I feel compelled to elaborate more so, a little bit more so, on poetry as a whole. And this book is, I mean, if poetry is the genus, this book is lyrical poetry. So it's kind of the species we're most familiar with in poetry. It's not like narrative poetry or a little bit more obscure, you know, like other kinds. Yeah, it is lyrical poetry, which are like shorter, rhyming generally, especially in the Romantic era, rhyming poetry with a set meter of some sort. Yeah, but in order to get in the mood of what poetry kind of entails, I think we should watch a clip from a movie called The Dead Poets Society. And this clip comes in right after Mr. Keating introduces the class to the poetry textbook and says, start reading from like the introduction. And then he calls his son to read to it. And then at the end of it, he goes, excrement. That's what I think of. Whoever, PhD. I want everyone to tear that out of their books. Tear it! I want to hear only ripping! Tear it! And then they all tear it out of their books. They roll it up and like throw it into this big bin. But what the introduction was, why it was so heinous to Mr. Keating, was that it was quantifying poetry in all these weird ways. In order to appreciate poetry, you must first understand the meter and the rhyme scheme. And then you could set up a chart of its importance and its aesthetic value or something. And you could figure out its like significance literarily by plotting this point and that point, depending on how you perceive its aesthetic qualities and its significance to other literary things. It was horrible. And so this clip comes right after that. Yeah, this is Songs of Experience and Innocence. He wrote one and then wrote the other years later, compiled them in 1804. Songs of Innocence and Experience. You could tell that his colors were so vibrant. That's what people like remember about a lot of his art. It's just so compelling. Okay. Yeah, if you could take play on that. Wait.
Words and language.
approach. I want anybody to tell you, words and ideas can change the world. It's not.
Can you not hear it?
Literature has nothing to do with going to business school, man. Right?
Take a look.
Can you play traffic?
I'll just turn it louder.
You shouldn't do this.
Oh, is there a remote for that? Okay. Will I also put it in this thing here? So let's see if the ion works.
You words and language. Like what anybody tells you. Words and ideas can change the world. Literature has nothing to do with going to business school, medical school, right? Mr. Hopkins, you may agree with him thinking, yes, we should simply study our Mr. Pritchard and learn our rhyme and meter and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. A secret for you. Good luck. Good luck! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits necessary to sustain life. Poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer that you are here, that life exists in identity. The powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. Powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
Yeah, so as an English major, well, all field. But if you caught what he said in the beginning, it's like, why do we write poetry? We do not write poetry because it's cute. We write poetry because we are members of the human race. And humanity is filled with passion. And I think growing up in such a strong Christian environment and learning answers to a lot of questions so readily, I sometimes neglect the question. And poetry helps me understand better the question, and therefore the answer as well. Let's see what a couple other people have to say about poetry. Robert Graves says this, "To be a poet is a condition, not a profession." John Piper... John Piper, he writes poetry, by the way. And in one of his poems that I like so much, he says in the preface this, "So quickly do we pass over the Christmas words, Herod slew all the male children 2 years old and under. But the poet lingers, weeping, raging, looking at the dark spot, in hope that any prick of light might become a portal for the sun. And what he sees, he strains with words to show, pressing us against the perforation in the wall of pain. Why this struggle? Why does the poet bind his heart with such a severe discipline of form? Why strain to give shape to suffering? Because reality has contours." I love that part. Reality has contours. Wallace Stevens says, "The poet is the priest of the invisible." The priest being one who represents one side to another. The poet is the priest of the invisible to us. And I can go on and on with describing poetry. but it gets kind of ethereal and abstract at a certain point. But I think, in essence, for us, for a working definition of poetry or a working understanding, in order to get more into the book that I want to share, we could establish that poetry is a special kind of literary art that seeks to give words to what in writing we call the unthought known, which is pretty much that which we already know implicitly, but have never given expression to verbally. Things we know and feel inside, though we have a hard time expressing them. And that's kind of what poetry does. There was one more thing I wanted to say regarding that. Okay, if it comes to me, I will. Because it's not just, we think of poetry as just rhyming words, you know, like rhyming sentences, or ones with meter. But it really is, as one person says, the essence of a language. And language is a reflection, or a mirror of the soul. It not only expresses things through the meaning of words put together, but also through the sounds and the way words are put together. So in this way, it uses the semantic, tonal, aural, and syntactic qualities of language, not only to use those things to express content through, but to be in itself an expression. And that's why we could have poems like the Jabberwocky, you know, "'Twas Brillig and the Slithy Toves did gyre and gimble in the wave," things like that, that actually convey something, because it doesn't only use the semantic meanings of words to convey things. It uses the tone and the nature of the words to convey things as well. So for William Blake's book, The Songs of Innocence and of Experience, the subtitle of that is "The Two Contrary States of the Human Soul." And Blake was one who really wrestled a lot in his life. He was kind of a prodigy of sorts, but he kind of always looked like a madman, kind of not very happy. He was always wrestling with the way things could be and the way things are. Politically, there's a lot of commentary, political commentary and social commentary, if you read through these poems. But what you could tell is he has a strong sense of what things should be, and a strong sense of sympathy with the human race. And so with those two things warring inside him, these lyrics just spill out. As one person says, poetry is the ashes of a life burning well. And I feel like he was really in tune with humanity and with ideals, such that the ashes of his life were really poignant, which is poetry. And I'll just share a couple right now. It's special for me to share one of these poems in front of TD, because I've heard my dad, growing up, I would hear my dad saying this, reciting this poem in different venues. But here's one from The Songs of Innocence, and each one corresponds with a song of experience. So on one hand, we get this childlike, it's a very romantic era feel to things, where childhood is a time of innocence, and then as you grow up, you become hardened and you recognize how complex life is. But he says this about the lamb. "Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. We are called by his name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I, a child, and thou, a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee." There's a softness to that, a tenderness, almost like a bleeding sound in some of those words, as he constructs not only an image of a lamb, but also kind of the essence of it. And then to contrast that, he goes to analyzing another animal. And this is one that you will read in your English textbooks hopefully in A.P. Wang or so. Yeah. The tiger. And it goes like this. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings did he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hands and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp, dare its deadly terrors clasp? And when the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? This was from the Romantic era, like I said, 1804. This is a long time ago. But there's still this warring inside of what things should be and how things are. If we're sensitive enough to both, we will feel that tension. And within that tension, then we can start creating beauty. And that's where art takes on this compelling feeling of, yes, you understand where I am. You are saying things I wish I could say. And you are expressing things which I knew, and everything feels like remembrance. That's what they say about poetry. It always feels like, I knew that, I'm remembering it, but you're saying it for the first time. And I think that's because we are born with that innate desire for the good. I want to share one last thing, and this is a kind of a modern accommodation or interpretation of the Songs of Innocence and the Songs of Experience. You know my favorite songwriter is John Foreman. And my favorite album of his is called The Vice Verses. And it's pretty much the same theme, warring in and out of how things are, how things should be. And he has this one passage in one of his songs that really does haunt me. And I wanted to share that with you all as a closing remark. So it goes, let the Pacific laugh, be on my epitaph, with its rising and falling, and after all, it's just water, and I am just soul, with a body of water and bones, where is God in the night sky, where is God in the city light, where is God in the earthquake, where is God in the genocide, where are you in my broken heart, everything seems to fall apart, everything feels rusted over, tell me that you are there. I know that there's a meaning to it all. A little resurrection every time I fall. You got your babies. I've got my hearses. Every blessing comes with a set of curses. I've got my vices. And I got my vice verses. These are my vice verses. These are my vice verses. As I was reflecting on this, poetry helps me to realize that there is a little resurrection every time we fall. Every day of our lives, we are rehearsing death and resurrection. And ultimately, we're caught in that narrative of death and resurrection. So there is hope for those of us who know the resurrected Christ. And we must share that hope, lest it just be a cycle of death for everyone else.
I want to read poetry. Let me get back. Rebecca, you ready?
Yeah.
All right.